Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Camila Kadalska. There's been a lot of talk about large swaths of public land going up for sale to help with housing in the West. We break down what's actually at stake.
What they're nervous about is the big portions of our public lands are not specifically, or what we can find are not specifically mentioned as not for sale.
School's out for the summer, but a lot is happening in the state's education system. Two lawsuits and school funding recalibration.
When schools are underfunded, we are not just trimming budgets, we are trimming children's futures.
And the current chair of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, or CPB, is Wyoming's own Ruby Calvert. She speaks on potential cuts to public media. Those stories and more. Stay with us. This is Open Spaces.
Want to do more than just listen to Wyoming Public Radio? You can help us through our new volunteer platform. We're looking for a few folks to pick up court documents, take photos, and promote local events. Sign up with the volunteer button at the top of our website. We depend on you as much as you rely on us.
Welcome to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Camila Kadalska. The last couple of weeks, there's been a whirlwind of news regarding the potential sale of public lands in 11 states, including Wyoming, for things like housing development. About 48% of the Cowboy State is owned and managed by the federal government, and Wyomingites have come out in droves protesting the potential sale. But the proposal has been getting pushback in the Senate as well. So to help make sense of all of this and get a better understanding of where it all stands now, Wyoming Public Radio's Caitlin Tan and Jackson Hole Community Radio's Dante Filippula-Inkney are here. The bill was just updated, so where does it stand now?
Yeah, so this is a proposal from Utah Republican Senator Mike Lee, and it has the potential to be added to the One Big Beautiful Bill. Now, the main thing to know about the changes: U.S. Forest Service land is out. It won't be for sale. But Bureau of Land Management parcels could still be offered up. Now, the new language says that that land has to be within 5 miles from population centers. But we haven't really gotten a definition of what population centers mean. Now, if this new proposal is passed, it mandates the BLM to sell up to 1.2 million acres of its land in 11 Mountain West states. Now, that doesn't include Montana. There's actually worry in Wyoming that this could include areas around Fremont Lake in Pinedale, the checkerboard near White Mountain in Rock Springs, or McCullough Peaks outside of Cody.
Yeah, not to mention it also could include a spattering of parcels along the Snake River here in Teton County. Lee tried to frame the changes as listening to feedback from hunters, but the original version was actually shot down. It didn't pass the muster of Senate rules. Has to do with something called the Byrd Rule. Basically, only budget stuff can go in a budget bill. And it was ruled Lee's bill is more on the policy side of things. But Lee's changes also come after intense public outrage over the last week from conservationists and recreationists and politicians across the aisle.
Yeah, and Caitlin, even with these changes, people are still mad. You saw some of that at a rally at the state capitol in Cheyenne Thursday, right?
Yeah, Thursday night, about 500 people showed up. They were spilling out of the Capitol steps and lawn. I saw lots of cowboy boots, hunter's orange, mountain bike shorts, people from all different backgrounds. Carly Provenza, a Democrat representative from Laramie, she spoke to the crowd and even dialed up Wyoming's 3 congressional members to ask them to vote no on any public land sell-off. So she left them a voicemail, but held the phone up to the crowd to voice their concerns.
Not for sale! Not for sale!
Then the rally actually finished off with Wyoming singer-songwriter Jalon Crossland.
One more time, slander.
Ultimately, the resounding sentiment across the political spectrum is people don't want their public lands sold for housing development.
And Caitlin, speaking of across the political spectrum, you've heard quite a bit from your neck of the woods in Sublette County.
Yeah, I mean, much like probably many of you, my Facebook page is filled with locals who are outraged. I actually spoke to a longtime horseshoer from Pinedale, Lonnie Johnson.
I'm damn sure not a Democrat, not a liberal, not a socialist. I voted for Trump, don't have nothing to hide.
But he says he's angry. He doesn't want public lands to change. Johnson even tried calling Wyoming's congressional members, but he says he got no answer and no calls back.
I love cowboying and working cows. I'm just enjoying the beauty of it. It's like living in a postcard. I would really not like that to be taken away.
Okay, so what was in the original bill and why did it rile people up?
Yeah, originally all BLM and Forest Service lands were potentially up for grabs with very few exemptions, and the order was to sell twice as much. The Wilderness Society, a national environmental advocacy group, created a map outlining what the about 3 million acres they thought the original bill would propose. It showed green swaths representing Forest Service land and orange swaths representing the BLM land. If your social feed was anything like mine, you've seen this map. I called Jordan Schreiber, who grew up in Jackson, but now spends most of her time in D.C. working with that group, the Wilderness Society.
We would love nothing more than for Senator Lee to put out a map that reflects his perception of this language, but he's not going to do that because he knows it will be unpopular. So this is our best guess based on the bill text.
However, as we've discussed, it's really a moot resource now. The proposed bill is now limited to BLM land.
Right. The updated version takes off the table any land that's not within 5 miles of a population center. Are there any other limitations in the updated version?
Yeah, there are some. It wouldn't include wildlife refuges, designated wilderness, recreation areas, or other federally protected land. Also, no land where there's an active grazing permit or lease, which in Wyoming is a lot of BLM parcels. And then the BLM needs to consult with the governor and nearby local governments and tribes about the suitability of the area for residential development.
Okay, and who can nominate land to be sold and what do they need to do?
Yeah, well, first, anyone can nominate a parcel, but there are some stipulations. They have to explain how they might want to use the land and how it will help with local housing needs. Supporters say this would be super helpful with affordable housing in the West, but the bill only says affordability once, and people are worried the phrasing is too open-ended, that it could mean mansions, golf courses, and pickleball courts in places like the Red Desert. Here's Schreiber again.
There's no guardrails, and there's no preconditions for affordability or really enforcement for the housing piece.
The parcels of land are then reviewed, approved or denied by the Secretary of the Interior. If it's approved, the parcel would go up for sale at fair market value. Now, some groups analyzing the text say that verbiage is squishy, that it doesn't ensure it'll be sold at fair market value. The overwhelming majority of the money made off the sales would go fund the federal government, like the U.S. Treasury. Supporters say it'll combat the national deficit, while critics say it wouldn't be that much money and very little would be reinvested in local communities. The bill says 5% goes to local governments and 10% goes to the BLM.
Okay, but wait one second. So what if the state, local government, or tribes don't approve of a certain parcel going for sale?
Yeah, I mean, the secretary could provide them the option to buy the land first, but the secretary doesn't have to. And tribes aren't specifically mentioned in this section. Now, it's just really important to remember everything we've talked about, that all has to happen within 5 years.
Got it. And has anything like this happened before?
Not really, at least not like this. Wyoming has floated the idea of taking over federal land before, you know, as recent as last legislative session, but it's never gone anywhere. And it would cost the state way too much money.
So how are Wyoming's U.S. delegates responding to all of this?
Well, U.S. Representative Harriet Hageman has supported it. So remember that Wilderness Society map that we mentioned earlier? Hageman spoke about it recently at a state legislative meeting, and she said people are blowing this way out of proportion. And so Representative Mike Schmid of LaBarge, he pushed back with a question to Hageman.
Would our federal delegation be able to inject some language into this bill or put my constituents' minds at ease that all of this federal land that looks like it's identified be excluded?
So there are no lands that have been identified, and that's one of that's some of the misinformation that is out there. The actual purpose of this bill is to identify the lands.
Hageman actually pointed to empty BLM lots in Las Vegas as an example of the types of lands the bill would target. She said there's even similar spots in Wyoming.
We've got a situation with Kemmerer. We need affordable housing there because of the development and what's going on, yet it's largely surrounded by BLM lands. This bill would target, you know, a 40-acre parcel so that you could develop it and provide affordable housing. This would all be done in conjunction with the states and the local communities and the stakeholders and Indian tribes and everything else.
As far as the rest of the Wyoming congressional delegation, we reached out to Senators John Barrasso and Cynthia Lummis, and they didn't respond by airtime. But Wyomingites have shared the letters they've gotten back from the senators. And they say they support federal land sales when it serves the interests of local communities.
Okay, and are we hearing anything from more local politicians?
Yeah, you know, this is interesting. As Dante mentioned, there was a lot of traction this year to actually pass a resolution calling for Congress to give Wyoming all federal public lands in the state. And so then at this recent legislative committee hearing, Representative Robert Wharf of Evanston echoed that push.
It's one of the things that amazes me. I've always struggled to understand why the residents of this state would rather let the federal government have control over our federal lands than have that transferred to the state.
But state lawmakers are still pretty mixed. I think they're hearing a lot from their constituents. Here's Representative Mike Schmidt again.
What they're nervous about is the big portions of our public lands are not specifically, or what we can find are not specifically mentioned as not for sale.
We should also mention Governor Mark Gordon said he supports the measure if there's careful state input.
Okay, so what are the next steps for the proposal?
We're still waiting to see if the updated proposal will pass muster with the Senate rules and make it into the one big beautiful bill. The U.S. Senate is trying to pass that bill before the 4th of July, and if it does, then it will be in the House's hands.
All right, well, thank you so much, you two.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks, Camila.
As of midday Friday, 5 GOP members in the House said they won't vote for the One Big Beautiful Bill if the public land sell-off is included. That would be enough to sink the whole bill in the House. Notably, Wyoming's Representative Hageman wasn't one of the five. As we just heard, lawmakers are pitching the sale of these public lands as a fix for the housing crisis. But as Rachel Cohen of the Mountain West News Bureau reports, many questions over the fast-moving proposals still linger, from the sweeping swaths of land that could be used to whether promises of affordable housing will materialize.
On a bright spring day, Tamara Pogue walks through an empty lot in the mountain town of Dillon, Colorado.
It's got some cement pads, it's got some dirt, a lot of dirt.
Pogue is a Summit County Commissioner. The land she's standing on is owned by the federal government.
I think when folks think about U.S. Forest Service land, they think about the pristine wilderness that we see across the reservoir.
But this is an old administrative site. It's right near town, and the agency used it to store equipment. Now, in a first-of-its-kind deal, the Forest Service is leasing the property to the county for affordable housing. Summit County is home to ski resorts like Breckenridge and Keystone. It's mostly surrounded by national forests, which limits its growth. Pogue says housing has always been tight, but it got worse during the pandemic.
We have neighborhoods in Summit County that were traditionally owned by working locals that literally flipped to second homeowners seemingly overnight.
Now the county's building around 160 rental units here for local workers. Federal officials think building on a lot more land controlled by the Bureau of Land Management could help tackle the lack of affordable housing across the West. Interior Secretary Doug Burgum says he's eyeing parcels that would work, and Utah Senator Mike Lee wants to go much further.
We're opening underused federal land to expand housing, support local development, and get Washington, D.C. out of the way of communities that are just trying to grow.
Lee unveiled his plan tucked in a federal budget bill in a video showing a car zooming through a dusty desert. He argues the federal government owns too much land, about a third of the U.S. Lee didn't respond to the Mountain West News Bureau's questions about his plan. As for Pogue, she's not on board.
People come to Summit County because of all of that federal land. So you need to be very careful in this conversation that you're really looking for parcels that are kind of within that urban footprint and not outside in the backcountry.
She says unlike the small project in her county, Lee's plan targets a massive area. Local communities could need to compete with private developers for the land, and most of the profits would go to D.C. But that doesn't bother Ed Lawson. He's the mayor of Sparks, Nevada.
I need the land more so than I need the proceeds from the sales.
Sparks is right next to Reno and is feeling the area's tech boom. More high-paid workers are driving prices up in the city, which is pushed up against BLM land.
That means supply and demand, which means higher housing prices.
He says he'd like to use nearby federal land for housing and for businesses to grow the city's tax base. Lee says his plan prioritizes building near developed areas. But Michael Carroll with the Wilderness Society says a read of the bill tells a different story. While it excludes national parks, it leaves a lot of prime outdoor spaces on the table.
Areas where we hike and take our dogs and, you know, spend time snowshoeing and mountain biking.
He says other places on the map don't make sense for housing because they're so remote. Maurice Page, who runs the Nevada Housing Coalition, is also skeptical.
I have sincere doubts.
He supports small-scale federal land transfers, part of a long-standing program in Las Vegas. But he says there's nothing in Lee's plan that requires any new housing to be affordable.
If you're giving away our land and only creating luxury or market rate housing, you're not given an opportunity for others to grow.
And even when land is available, that's just the beginning. In Summit County, Colorado, almost 2 years after the lease was signed, building hasn't started on the Forest Service property. Ironing out agreements and piecing together funding are more hurdles before move-in. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Rachel Cohen.
Up next, with all of this talk of selling federal land, what might it look like if states took over management?
This time on the Modern West, we trek out into the National Elk Refuge and hear all about the debate over whether to wean elk off winter feeding before chronic wasting disease strikes.
You know, it's like an alcoholic. Oh, I won't drink as much and I'll be okay. Yeah, it doesn't really work like that.
Wasting Away, it's part six of The Gray in Between. Find it under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. State control of federal land is nothing new. Conservatives in parts of the West have talked about this, like Senator Bob Eyde from Casper, who we heard from a few weeks ago.
We should be a sovereign state with jurisdiction on everything within our borders.
But if this happened, there is no guarantee the public would maintain access, and many states simply can't take on more land. Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Mersbach reports.
Near the end of a long dirt road outside the small city of Casper, Carolyn Griffith's tan A-frame house sits in front of a towering mountainous ridge.
This is the foothills of Casper Mountain.
As chickadees sing, the 65-year-old says the wide-open area is pretty tranquil. But that was all turned upside down on one February afternoon last year.
I noticed a backhoe going onto the state land.
Land that right now is open for recreation, but is in a state trust. Griffith and her neighbors learned mining was approved there.
The individual that was in the backhoe produced a permit for a potential gravel pit. So we were all pretty shocked at that.
She's worried about mining operations impacting the fragile aquifer she relies on for drinking. Others are worried about losing their place to birdwatch or walk their dogs. Things that don't exactly make the state money.
State trust land is not public land. It's trust land.
Jason Crowder says trust land has to be used to fund K-12 education. He used to run the office that manages the land.
Office of State Lands and Investments is not the BLM. It's not the Forest Service. We have different missions.
Federal lands are managed for multiple uses, but on many state lands in Wyoming and beyond, recreation comes second. Some states allow day use like picnicking or fishing, but camping? Not so much.
We're here to optimize revenue.
There's a lot of tension over that. Outside Casper, hundreds of Wyomingites have fought wind farms or glamping operations on other parcels of state trust land.
But what's lost in that criticism is that the office has a fiduciary duty, a duty higher than all others.
And that's why many are worried about proposals in Congress to transfer federal land over to states or private ownership. Some conservatives want the state to take over all 30 million acres of federal public land in Wyoming, about 9 times more than the state currently manages. State lawmaker Bill Landon, who represents Casper, thinks specific parcels would be better managed locally.
It just feels like to me there's an opportunity at the national level right now.
But if federal lands are turned over to states, there's no guarantee that land would stay public. Wyoming has sold about 20% of its state land in the past 2 centuries. Utah has sold about 50%. In Nevada, nearly all. Plus, the state might not have the capacity to take on more land. The state trust agency has 5 field staff for 3.4 million acres, and the state parks department's budget has shrunk. It has fewer resources than it did 15 years ago. That's why environmentalists like Josh Metten with a hunting and angling group say land management should be left as it is.
We understand that there are issues with how federal agencies are managed, but our federal agencies have more capacity to do public outreach.
State lawmakers actually commissioned a study on this in 2015. They wanted to manage federal lands, but learned there's no way Wyoming could afford it with the system currently in place. Utah has created an office which would take over management. That hasn't happened in Wyoming. Some lawmakers say they want to create a new state public land category, but that doesn't exist yet.
There is no clear way to take federal public land and just transition it into a state public land.
In the foothills of Casper Mountain, Carolyn Griffith gestures to her floor-to-ceiling window at the open landscape.
We knew there were state lands. We also knew there was a fragile water supply and certainly didn't think that, you know, digging a pit through that would be a good choice for the land.
After a year of pushback, the gravel mine project ended up largely failing. Wyoming's top officials didn't renew most of the leases. But Griffith knows with state management, there could be another threat down that long dirt road. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Hannah Merzbach in Casper, Wyoming.
Last week on the show, we heard from Wyoming Public Media's general manager on how the station's funding will be impacted by potential cuts to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, or CPB. The U.S. House has passed a package that would eliminate 2 years of forward funding that CPB has already allocated. Jackson Hole Community Radio's Sophia Boyd-Fliegel sat down with Ruby Calvert, chair of the board for the CPB, which helps fund NPR and PBS.
Well, Ms. Calvert, you spent decades managing and producing for Wyoming PBS, and you're still based in Riverton. You're a Republican and come from a conservative background. How do you approach conversations with people in your party and maybe even Wyoming's own elected officials on the topic of defunding CPB?
Well, I think it's important for everyone to understand how the funding works when it goes to CPB and then where it goes from when it leaves CPB. And when I talk to my conservative colleagues, you know, I explain that it probably 95% of the funding goes out to stations in some form or other, direct community service grants or some sort of support grants. In general, Republican colleagues are in favor of the local stations. I mean, they want that local autonomy. They want the local stories, history, culture. I mean, I think it does not matter whether you're conservative or not. Those are important to your communities.
I want to just get one clarification out of the way. Congress can defund CPB, but it can't defund PBS or NPR, these member stations, separate entities entirely. So if the Senate votes the way the House just did, what will Americans be left with in that public media landscape? What will survive?
Well, that's a really good question. I mean, and it is correct that the funding that comes to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting directly from Congress, we are an independent nonprofit corporation. The legislators and congressional delegation who created the Corporation for Public Broadcasting specifically designed it so that there would not be political interference. And I think it would be very difficult for Wyoming PBS, for example, to raise $1.3 million in a year to have it come in and help pay the electric bills and pay the staff. It's not, however, just the community service grants. I mean, we also pay a lot of the music rights. And there's an economies of scale because we negotiate those rights for all stations. I can't say strongly enough that a cut would definitely hurt rural markets because you don't have the access to thousands and thousands of listeners or viewers. So you don't have the membership. And in fact, a lot of rural stations, CPB funding makes up as much as 40 to 50% of their budget.
Yeah, you talked about cultural programming, helping us get music on the air. That's one side of the issue that I do think is a little more hidden. The other that's at the forefront of this discussion with the rescission is these accusations of bias. So what's your defense when you field these accusations of bias coverage?
Well, the first thing we want to make clear is that, you know, our CPB, we are in charge of receiving the funds from Congress and distributing the funding to stations. And neither PBS nor NPR are any part of CPB. So there is an autonomy that local stations have in terms of what programs they pick, what programs they air, and then what kind of feedback they give to NPR or PBS. You know, everybody has an omission or an issue that maybe they forgot to cover. I'm not saying that hasn't happened to a lot of seasoned folks too, but I think it really helps to have people who have more experience in the field. And I would just hope that as we go along here, knowing this bias issue has surfaced, that we pay really careful attention in our newsrooms to just that oversight of all those stories and who's represented in those stories. The more we can assist local stations in determining where those omissions might be occurring, I think things will get better and better.
I know that this is not a new fight. I heard you recall like the shock that you felt when a cadre of politicians led by Newt Gingrich were advocating for CPB cuts when you're still in programming. The conversation came back up in 2017, and it's really been around since the creation of CPB when it was first established. What feels different this time?
Part of it is the preponderance of conservative voices. In 2012, when Newt Gingrich stood on the Capitol steps and called out a Contract for America and defunding public broadcasting, I think it's interesting to note that after all that time, Newt Gingrich just produced a documentary on immigration. And where did he bring it? He brought it to PBS. Every time we're threatened, We take a look at the things that we've done over the last 2 or 3 or 5 years, and people say, oh, yeah, that's right. That was really important. And particularly the children's programming on PBS. I mean, all of my children were raised on public television. And, there are so many 3 and 4-year-olds who cannot go to preschool. They learn their colors and letters and empathy off of public television programming. I don't want to see public television and public radio go down on my watch. That is for sure.
Ms. Calvert, I can hear the emotion and the determination in your voice. Thanks for joining us here today on KHOL.
You bet. Thank you.
That was Ruby Calvert, who chairs the board of CPB, speaking with Jackson Hole Community Radio's Sophia Boyd-Fliegel about a package that would defund 2 years of CPB funding to local PBS and public radio stations, including Wyoming Public Radio and Jackson Hole Community Radio. It's the summer, but there's been a lot of debate around the funding of the state's education system. That's up next on Open Spaces.
Hello, Human Nature listeners. This is Megan Feary, the host of the show, here to tell you that a brand new season is coming your way May 21st. This season, you'll hear the story of a woman who overcame incredible hardships by turning to her constant companion, the river. Also, the story about how a random act of kindness saved an animal sanctuary in need. And Fitz Cajal, host of the Dirtbag Diaries podcast, joins me to discuss his new book. Find Human Nature on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Camila Kadalska. The Wyoming Education Association sued the state's Department of Education earlier this month. The lawsuit is aimed at the expanded school voucher program lawmakers passed this year. The association argues the money allocated for the vouchers could be better spent funding the state's public school system, among other reasons. This just as the association won a different lawsuit finding the public school system is underfunded. And on top of all of this, state lawmakers are currently recalibrating the funding model for schools. That's a lot. So to help untangle and make sense of all of this, Wyoming Public Radio's Jeff Victor is joining me today.
Happy to help out.
Okay, so this is all happening as state lawmakers are looking at the funding model, or what is also known as recalibration, right?
Yeah, so recalibration. Let's start there. This is the process of reexamining, reworking how the state government pays for public schools across Wyoming. This is mandated by law every 5 years. Like we mentioned at the top, the Education Association, which represents teachers, won an earlier lawsuit that found the Department of Education is violating the state's constitution. That's because the constitution requires the state to provide a, quote, complete and uniform system of public education that's free for everyone and is the highest quality it can be. In the lawsuit, the court ruled that Wyoming had been failing to do this because schools couldn't pay teachers adequate, reasonable wages or provide nutritious meals or put much money into mental health resources.
So if I'm understanding correctly, lawmakers are required by law to fund the education department better?
That's right. And lawmakers have already started the recalibration process. To be clear, they had to do that already. The court ruling just gives them some direction about how to do that. This process, recalibration, includes getting feedback from stakeholders and crafting a plan that follows the Constitution and other state laws. I listened in to a recent meeting of the Select Committee on School Finance Recalibration, and I caught several hours of public testimony. Lots of people had lots of ideas about how Wyoming should fund schools. One person, Mary Schmidt, proposed eliminating school libraries.
A teacher does not send students at high school to go to the library and research the Cold War. Where do they send them? To their computers. So are we spending money on libraries? For what?
Others wanted to see more career and technical training. Rob Hill told lawmakers those programs usually have more demand than capacity.
We've got a lot of kids that want in these classes. These are our workforce. And we can't get them through those bottlenecks at level one.
And several people showed up to the meeting wearing shirts that read, Save Wyoming's Public Schools. The majority of public comment agreed that schools are underfunded. Like Robin Edwards. She was a teacher in Johnson County for more than two decades.
When schools are underfunded, we are not just trimming budgets, we are trimming children's futures.
She asked lawmakers not to cut mental health supports or librarians or hot meals.
So people are worried about the funding of public schools in the state. This ties in with the new Education Association's lawsuit that was filed earlier this month. Is that right?
Yeah. So the new lawsuit specifically targets school vouchers. For context, these vouchers are public money, but they can be used for private or homeschooling.
Okay. And how much are we talking, and what families are eligible?
So the dollar amount and the eligibility requirements have actually both been changed recently. In 2025, lawmakers expanded the program, boosting that payment to $7,000, and removing the income cap altogether. So now any family, regardless of income, can access these vouchers.
Do we know how many families are taking advantage of this?
Technically, so far, no one has received this money. The program is scheduled to start for the fall 2025 semester, so this coming school year. But we do know from the Department of Education that nearly 4,000 families have already applied.
Wow. Okay. And how much money has Wyoming put toward the program?
A total of about $50 million. And supporters of the voucher program have been adamant that it will not take money away from public schools. Governor Mark Gordon said as much during the bill's public signing.
Public schools are going to still have the funding that they need. And this is a commitment by the state of Wyoming on this and in expanding this.
But opponents warn the voucher program could indeed divert money away from public education.
How so?
They argue that $50 million set aside for private school vouchers could have been reallocated to public education instead. So that brings us to the Education Association launching this other newer lawsuit against the state to stop those voucher payments from going out. Here's Kim Amon, the president of the association.
We believe that public schools are the center of our communities and the heart of Wyoming, and that we should be investing in them and not diverting money away from them.
From Amon's perspective, the real issue is that private schools are not like public schools. They don't have to follow the same standards, and they don't have the same oversight that public schools do. They're also not held to the same standards when it comes to discrimination. Here's Amon again.
Our public schools take every student, they're for every student in Wyoming, regardless of where they live, regardless of their special needs, regardless of their gender identity. What private schools don't have to do is take every single student.
And that's why other plaintiffs have joined this lawsuit.
There's other plaintiffs?
Yeah. So 9 public school parents across the state are also attached to the lawsuit. Most of them have children with disabilities or children who are trans or non-binary. Brandon Vickers, a father from Moreland, has both. He told me he doesn't think public education funding should go to schools that can discriminate against his children or any other children. He also said,
it takes resources away from public schools, which are already struggling in almost every way. How are you going to fund both a well-functioning, high-functioning public school system, and then also maintain this voucher system?
Okay, and how's the Wyoming Department of Education reacting to all this?
So Superintendent Megan Degenfelder said she will fight for the voucher program in court. In a press release, she said she fully intends to give these vouchers out come fall. But of course, we'll have to see what the court does. We'll probably know soon whether the judge will temporarily pause these voucher payments, and we'll have a clearer picture of where this lawsuit might go.
And meanwhile, recalibration just continues?
Yep. And a lot of the meat and potatoes of actually putting together a funding model will be done by a private consulting firm. However, ultimately, it is important to note that decisions about how to fund schools will be made by elected officials.
Awesome. Thanks, Jeff.
Sure thing.
Staying in the world of education. Earlier this month, the 137-year-old University of Wyoming Lab School sent their students home for summer vacation the very last time. Last year, UW gave the Albany County School District notice that they wouldn't be renewing their agreement to house the school. A last-ditch effort by state lawmakers to pass a bill to rescue it also failed. Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards spoke with 2 former staff members about what they think led to the school's shutdown.
From the very beginning, the lab school was started as a place to train teachers. That was way back when Wyoming was still aspiring to statehood. Virginia Chai came to the school for her teacher training. Later, all 4 of her children attended, and for over a decade, she worked there as the administrative assistant. Chai says the school's final day of classes was painful.
There's so many children that are really uneasy. So many that lingered in the office, wanting to say goodbye, to special teachers. Lots of tears, lots of hugs. so much uncertainty, and I feel I tried to encourage them. It's going to be good. It's going to be okay. These new schools are going to be great. They're going to welcome you. I don't really know that. I mean, I hope that. It's not going to be the same.
In what way do you feel like it's not going to be the same?
Sure. I think the smallness of our school, not just class size, but that we only have like max 300 students at a time, really has helped them. And I think they feel seen. And some of our kids are, they're anxious kids. They need somebody to just say, hey, you're good. We see you. We appreciate that you're here, even if you're late, you know.
Chai grew up in small town South Dakota and says she'd never experienced teaching and learning like what she saw in those classrooms.
A lot of it was student-led and really authentic learning. They were building teepees in classrooms and learning, like, deep diving into Egyptian history and complex mathematics, where they would take certain problems and go at it in way different ways. And so just a very special place.
Chai says up until recently, the school district treated lab school teachers as experts in their fields.
They were given freedom. They were given the chance to choose how they taught, and you could tell the students were just on fire for learning.
But the former head teacher of the lab school, Meredith McLaughlin, says that changed 3 years ago. That's when longtime principal Margaret Hudson retired. McLaughlin says the Albany County Superintendent John Goldhart hired a replacement without getting input from the university or other stakeholders, something she says the district hadn't done in the school's history. McLaughlin worked at lab school for over two decades.
Brooke Fergon was appointed as a principal. She was elected with zero stakeholder input. She fired and threatened staff. Plenty of those teachers lost those jobs, and she was moved into an assistant principal position at Laramie High School. People ask me what happened at the lab school. I'm like, really, only one thing happened at the lab school. Lab school stakeholders couldn't choose their own principal, and that's it. That's the only thing that really happened. Who was in power to prevent that from happening? John Goldhart. We can talk about the College of Ed, and they certainly could have saved it. The University of Wyoming could have stepped up and saved it. But they were not the ones who killed it. University of Wyoming was not. And I know because I was there. I lived it.
McLaughlin says the culture of the school changed when Fergon became principal. The school had long been known for its unique outdoor education and hands-on learning approach for students kindergarten through eighth grade. Since its inception, McLaughlin says the school used site-based management, giving teachers the creative space to develop curriculum. Now the school district had different ideas.
So one of the things that happened to us, like one of the reasons that I left, is I knew I would be disciplined if I didn't implement Wit and Wisdom. I knew that was going to happen. And I also knew I was an extremely successful English teacher who did not need that. It's a scripted curriculum program that is used as the hook, line, and sinker curriculum by Albany County School District and several other school districts around the state.
McLaughlin says she doesn't have a problem with the curriculum itself, even though it wasn't developed by the Wyoming Department of Education, but from a for-profit Virginia company called Great Minds. Albany County School District promoted the program, but she does have a problem with its implementation.
Like, for example, Patty Smith, who took my job, she chose not to use Wit and Wisdom curriculum. She had to have a weekly meeting with Brooke Fergon, the principal, with one instructional facilitator, who demanded that she write down everything she was going to say in the classroom. Are you kidding me? It's scary. It's terrifying. We really do need to find a way to restore education to the public and public to education. It's really imperative for our democracy right now. And if you look at the exodus around the state, we're like, it's my way or the highway. And you'll hear that all over the state. The term for it is moral injury. We suffered moral injury.
McLaughlin is willing to share her story now because she no longer is an employee with the Albany County School District. She's currently a doctoral researcher at the University College London and moving to Illinois to teach educators there.
Were we always way more qualified than we should have been to be teaching kids in school? Sure. But we would have done it until the day we died, because it meant something. It was a dialogue between families and children and you. And when that was taken away and you were told that you must do something that you knew weren't what families needed or children needed or wanted, then you're doing something that's against your integrity. And if you are threatened with your job security, then you're going to leave, because it is moral injury to stay.
Virginia Chai, the school's administrative assistant, says to the district's credit, they've hired some former lab school teachers as part of an extension team to share their methods with other schools in the district. But Chai has some advice for the district going forward.
You have to allow your educators to be creative. Otherwise, they're not going to stay teachers. I know of probably 10 teachers who have left our district because it's just been really unbearable, the management of them.
Wyoming Public Radio reached out to both former principal Brooke Furgon and Superintendent John Goldhart for their comments. In response to questions about his hiring process and the change of culture at the school, Goldhart replied, quote, "It would not only be illegal, but highly unethical to discuss personnel issues." And he said, quote, "The University of Wyoming Board of Trustees made a decision to close the lab school. We're moving forward with that decision and preparing a positive transition for former lab students to their neighborhood schools." For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Melody Edwards.
It's hard for people with physical disabilities to enjoy our public land, but Grand Teton National Park is trying to make certain trails more accessible. That's up next on Open Spaces.
Can't have the radio on all day, but want to keep up to date with Wyoming news? Then check out our new daily podcast, The Wyoming Debrief. Get daily news around Wyoming and test your knowledge of the cowboy state with some trivia. All of that in under 10 minutes. Find Wyoming Debrief wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. The Taggart Lake Trail is Grand Teton National Park's most popular. Over 300,000 people visit annually, from winter skis to summer hikes. But for many people with physical disabilities, the alpine lake at the trail's end is inaccessible. The park is changing that, with input from an adaptive athlete in Jackson. Jackson Hole Community Radio's Dante Filippula Ankeny reports that small changes can make a big difference for disabled recreators looking for a remote wilderness experience.
Joe Stone doesn't mind the stares and adulation as he motors his $20,000 mobility device, a titanium trike of sorts, over jagged rock and narrow bridges. A kid tells his parents he'd like one as Stone passes by. An old man asks, "How fast does it go?" And others with gaping jaws let their thoughts escape them. "Wow," they say, as the mountain bike-like device pivots, shifts, creaks, and rolls atop obstacles. Stone's used to the attention, patient with it, responding to each with earnest. He knows he's not the typical trail user.
I mean, gaining access to something like Taggart or other trails, things off the pavement, hasn't really been possible for people with disabilities for almost all of history.
But Stone's work aims to change that. He co-leads Dovetail Trail Consulting. The group guides land agencies and other recreation organizations to make trails more accessible for people with disabilities.
Trying to demystify what it means to have a disability and what it is people with disabilities are trying to do. So there are people with disabilities that want to go on more adventurous trails that are more technical, that are going to be like what we're about to encounter here at Taggart.
His recommended changes are minimal, slightly widening trails and bridges and minimizing significant trail barriers like large stumps and rocks. He pushes back on the idea that trail work like this will sacrifice sustainability or ruin its rigor by flattening it.
When they start to realize it's not huge differences, it's a lot of minor tweaks, that's when we start seeing access open up more and more and more.
As we hike the mile and a half to Taggart Lake, he points to steps that could be made into a more gradual grade and stumps that jut out just a little too high. Though Stone needs help pulling his beefed up mobility device over a large rock only once, he knows that's likely not the case for others.
We're not saying take away all the trail characteristics and make it paved all the way to Taggart. Still make it an adventurous trail, but can we do it in a way that's better and more sustainable for the trail so that it lasts longer and it'll be here in 50 years with not very much maintenance on it?
In 2010, Stone was descending a mountain with a glider, a sport known as speed flying, when an accident left him unable to walk.
So in the early days, like when I was still laying in the hospital, I legitimately thought the rest of my life was going to be in a nursing home, 100% dependent on everyone around me. So it was almost like, why am I alive?
But he started watching videos online, learning more about the outdoor opportunities still available to him. And within a year, he was able to hand cycle the Going to the Sun Road in Glacier National Park.
One day before the 1 year anniversary of my accident, and that's really what my soul needed.
Early after his accident, it was difficult to get into more remote wilderness settings. Trails were too narrow and steep. Obstacles were too large, and the technology of mobility devices wasn't cutting it.
And then as that technology got better and better, like it's only been since, I would say realistically, the last like 7 or 8 years that it has really turned around and opened up the door for a lot of people with disabilities to be able to get out and get off the pavement.
Mountain bikes aren't allowed on most trails in national parks. Stone's mobility device resembles one, and he's gotten scolded by park rangers and other trail users before for riding in restricted areas. He has to tell them he is allowed under federal accessibility laws. That advocacy for himself led him to start advocating for others.
We're trying to work with the trails that already exist or new trails being built to make them work for everyone.
Like the Taggart Lake Trail in Grand Teton National Park, less than an hour from his home, it's meaningful work.
Like, what does it mean? I mean, for me, it's everything. Like, being able to get away, to get into nature, we're seeking all the same things that everybody else is.
On our way down, Stone passes a trail crew that recognizes him. He stops and chats. They're closing part of the trail to finish up one of his recommendations, widening a bridge. Previously, Stone's trike would have been too wide to cross, scraping rocks to each side or bouncing dangerously close to its edge. For him and others, it's a big deal, and he hopes it inspires more work in the future.
There's just not a lot of opportunities out there for people with disabilities to get on a trail and get to something spectacular. And so that's why this trail is like, well, if we just do a little bit of work, like we could make it that. And that there aren't many of those out there, which is really setting an example of how things can move forward in the future for like all of our national parks.
By the end of the season, it's expected that Stone's recommendations and the trail crew's work will allow access for the many with disabilities looking for a wilderness experience. Dante Fopala-Ankeny, KHOL News.
Thank you for listening to Open Spaces. The entire show and all the stories you heard here can be found on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. It can also be found wherever you get your podcasts, and we post all our stories on the station's social media platforms. A thanks to Melody Edwards, this episode's audio producer, Ivy Engel, our digital producer, and Cody Hume, our social media manager. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.